Hello and welcome to another edition of the How to Grow Your E-Commerce Business podcast. I'm here with Rob Green from the I'm the One podcast. Rob is also a big Amazon seller. So Rob, could you start off by telling us about your business journey?
Yeah, sure. I think I'm like a lot of people that became entrepreneurs. They worked in corporate America and hated every moment of it. I just didn't know how to get out of it. So worked in corporate America for quite a while. Started e-commerce in 2011, drop shipping. Transferred over to private labeling in 2015, where I launched my first brand. Since I've launched quite a few brands, I've sold a few brands, I bought a brand. We currently operate a handful of brands right now, and we're looking to acquire some more brands here in the very near future.
So tell us about your brands. What was the first brand you launched?
It was a dog brand, and my first private label product was a little dog booster seat for small dogs. This is an American thing, probably trend. But you put it around the headrest, and it's for dogs under 20 pounds, and it boosts them up so they can see out the window. Real first world problem solver, Trevor.
Yeah, that is what we would call in the UK a middle class problem.
I call it first world problems. But there's good demand. It was an easy product to improve upon. So we made a better product with a metal frame. It was collapsible. We sold 30 to 40 of those things every day for years.
It was an
unbelievable product.
So you have your own products that you design yourself, as opposed to kind of white label products you buy on Alibaba.
Yeah, we've done both, but we found that we do better when we add to or improve the existing products in the marketplace. And nowadays, I mean, this was 2015, when it was much harder to get customer sentiment. Now we utilize AI to understand the marketplace, what the gaps are in a specific product niche, what the opportunities are to improve the features. It's much easier nowadays to see what the market actually wants.
So what tools do you use, AI tools do you use to do that?
We've done a bunch. Typically, when we first started, we used ChatGPT. Shulex, which is VOC.ai, mm-hmm. Voice of the Customer. We've used their sentiment tool. It's an overlay on Amazon. But the whole idea is and there's a bunch of them now to do this, I believe, but you're basically downloading all the customer reviews and you can extract sentiment, positive or negative. And even using AI, you can actually identify features that you want, that they're calling out, that they want, that the product doesn't have. So it makes it a heck of a lot easier nowadays to improve products.
What, so you'd use something like Helium 10 to download all the feedback, mm-hmm. and then put it through an AI tool and ask it to summarize it?
Yep.
Okay. That's really cool, because I mean, I'm not exactly an AI skeptic, but I do see a lot of the stuff. Oh. I mean, that, you know, there's a whole lot of things that people are expecting AI to do, which I just think, God, mate, if you have to get AI to do this, then you need to be in a different business, because, you know, a lot of it's like, you know, getting AI to write product descriptions. And I think, well, you can't just, what I would call a shit in, shit out problem. You can't just expect this thing to start from zero.
Okay, Trevor, I'm going to challenge you on this, buddy. I'm going to challenge you. So recently, I'd say 5-6 weeks ago, ChatGPT came out with the ability to train your own custom GPTs. So I took everything I know about Amazon, writing listings, organic ranking, keywords. I created a GPT. I feed in title, bullets, description of my product and the best-selling product. And what I get out is better than 99% of sellers in the way that they write listings.
Okay. So I'm just not where it's at. I need to get with the program.
I'm happy to show you what we put together. I mean, I couldn't believe the quality that comes out. It can analyze your image and my image. It can analyze them, not just like spit out a summary. It can analyze the images. It can analyze the titles. The key really, though, is you do have to have – it's garbage in, garbage out. You do have to have the knowledge to train the AI to what you want it to do. I mean, some random person on the street just said, write me a listing. It's not going to be great. I completely agree with you there. But if you have specialized knowledge and train it, it's really, really amazing what it can put out nowadays.
Okay. Gosh, I need to play with that then, I think. So what do you look for in a brand when you're thinking, okay, I need to launch a new range of products. What do you look for?
So we're doing this right now. We're looking for, I mean, I think the big thing that I've learned over the last decade or so is number one, I want a rising tide. So I don't want to create or buy a brand in something where the market is shrinking. Don't want to find. Yeah. I want something that's hopefully got some legs and it's going to last a while. Those are the two things that I look at first. Then do we have good unit economics? So often when we have products that we've done good volume, but not maybe a lot of profit, is because the unit economics weren't there. And as, you know, it's gotten more difficult the last few years on Amazon or any marketplace, shipping's gone up, COGS have gone up, tariffs have gone up. It's more and more difficult to extract profit. So you've got to have enough margin, like a margin of safety from a unit economics perspective. And too often we've tried to squeeze it out of it. And at the end of the day, that just makes it a really, really tough business if you don't have the good gross profit margin you need.
So what kind of gross profit margin do you look for in a product?
Got to be 70. You've got to have 70 at least. At least 70. Otherwise, you're in trouble.
So what is that 70? What does that include? So is that the cost, just the cost price, or is it?
Yeah, that's just COGS. So if you take the sales price minus COGS, you have to have at least 70% margin. You have to in today's market. If you're selling on a marketplace, just to be clear, you don't have to have that on Shopify necessarily, depending on your cost per acquisition. But on a marketplace, Amazon is taking 30%, 33%, depending if you're using FBA. That's off the top. Not including the refunds, and then obviously your advertising costs.
So are you a fan of, I mean, because I have a love-hate relationship with Amazon. I mean, I think it's amazing in some ways, but they're a horrible company to work with. And
they are, you know, they're a challenge. I have a love-hate relationship with them also. I go to Amazon. I was just there in Seattle a couple of weeks ago to give feedback on FBA and on listings and things like that. So I've had a lot of interaction with them over the years and try to give them as much feedback to make the platform better. What's always surprised me about Amazon is we think of Amazon as one thing, and it's hundreds of thousands of people, right? And every individual I deal with Amazon,
it's like the fifth biggest employer in the world or something. I mean, it's got like a million employees.
Huge number of employees. And what's interesting is when I deal with people one-on-one there, especially at a higher level, a director level, executive level, they're amazing. And they tell me how much they love sellers and they want to help us. And then I'm like, but that's not what the experience that we get. On a one-to-one level, it's amazing. It just sometimes doesn't translate in the messaging. I think that was my big feedback last time I was up there, is your messaging isn't ideal. They said their goal in 2024 is lowering the cost to serve us. And I said, That sounds amazing.
They're either going to have to get rid of some of it, because from my perspective, what I see is they're adding more and more and more hoops that you have to jump through and less information about how to do it. And so it's very hard to know what the important things you need to keep up with are. Which are the things that are going to mean that your account's shut down? Because they don't really tell you. And if you, it's always a game of guess why we're upset with you. Because if they close down your account, they frequently won't tell you what the actual problem is. And no one, and they, you know, they've got this opaque, it's like some sort of, I don't know if you've read any Franz Kafka, The Trial, you know, it's this kind of Kafka-esque nightmare. It's just, you know, one day there'll be some, you know, this is what monopolies do. They give people terrible service. And I think we're seeing it more and more on Amazon. But, you know, Amazon's what I do all day. So I probably shouldn't complain too much. What other channels do you like? Would you find successful?
We sell on Walmart and Shopify also, but the big focus for us right now is TikTok Shops. So Shops launched in September in the US, and we are selling on Shops now, but we are spending a good amount of time and energy to figure out TikTok Shops. The volume seems to be very strong. We haven't cracked the code yet, I guess you could say, but we are definitely working on that right now because there's a ton of volume on TikTok Shops in the US.
Because I think TikTok Shops is commission based, isn't it? So it's like a marketplace where you offer a commission to. I just think that's a really good idea. I think it enables retailers to tap into influencers in a way that, you know, it means that, you know, you benefit from their experience of being an influencer, but you don't have to, you know, just pay up front. I'm amazed that Facebook haven't done this before.
It's one of the best platforms of performance-based marketing.
Yeah, I'm telling all our clients they need to get on TikTok Shop because it's free to set up. It's a total no-brainer.
And it's the commission, no-brainer.
So do you offer, because it's like 5% to TikTok, and then what kind of commissions do you find you have to pay to the influencers?
We're at 10 to 15 to influencers, but right now it's free to TikTok in the US right now in the beginning.
And so do you find that you have to give, you know, do you give out free products to influencers as well?
Yes. Yeah. So but I look at it, I look at it that way. I say, okay, let's say I have a product that sells well on Amazon. Let's say it sells 50 to 100 units a day. Okay.
Yeah.
If I go and give 100 away to TikTok influencers, and let's say it's a $10 product to make it, 10 bucks to ship it. Let's just use some easy numbers. That's $2,000. Well, that's a one-time $2,000 investment in ads. I definitely spend more than that on a monthly basis for that product on Amazon ads. So I think of it that way.
Yeah. So you would get, okay, so what do you, because it's all committed. So you, but you're finding there's enough kind of influencers who are interested in your kind of products.
Yeah. Oh God, there's a billion creators out there, because think about it this way. The number one, I've been using a bunch of tools to kind of research and figure out this, the marketplace. The number one woman influencer, on TikTok shops in the US last month generated $1.7 million in revenue. As an influencer. Okay, so let's just say she's getting 10%. She made $170,000 as an influencer. And she doesn't have her name's not Kardashian. She doesn't have 100 million followers. She's got 30, 40,000 followers maybe. So there is, I mean, that, and that's the high end, but there's hundreds of them making good money. So there's a big, big push for a lot of them to start creating product videos.
Yeah, I think it's something, because I think it's it, you know, something like a like Instagram, you have to go individually to the influencer and make a deal with them, and they're going to want, you know, like a payment for showing your products. I mean, it's just not very attractive, is it? And it's kind of out of the reach of you know, smaller brands. You know,
well, the challenge we've had with that strategy in the past is that there's no pay for performance. It's just paying for posting or sharing or reviewing a product or whatever it might be, right? I want to pay for performance. I happily give you a percentage of all the sales you generate every day of the week because it's performance.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, because as a marketplace seller, you're used to doing that. So
I've always loved pay for performance. It just makes sense.
Yeah, I think it's excellent. Well, I'm excited to hear your success with that, because I think, you know, it's one of those things that, you know, is up and coming. I'm just saying to people, we really need to do this. I think it's quite exciting. So going on, so what kind of role does data play in your marketing?
Yeah, we tend to be a little more heavy on the data side. I know a lot of people aren't as comfortable with the data. You now, especially as a marketplace, Amazon has released a lot more data. There's search query performance, we call it SQP, data that they have sharing. They're now sharing the funnel data. So I can look at one ASIN and Amazon will give me the data relative to the marketplace. It'll show me my impression data, my click data, my add to cart data, my purchase conversion data relative to the marketplace. So I can see how my ASIN is doing throughout the entire funnel on Amazon's platform relative to the rest of the market. So I can understand where I'm winning, where I'm doing okay, and where I'm losing. That we use that data to inform our advertising, our listing creation. You know, we lean into the stuff that we have an advantage over the market, and then we pull back on the keywords, for example, that we don't have an advantage in the market.
Okay. So do you, what kind of, I mean, so this is just from the Amazon Business Reports, that data's in there?
It's actually a different piece inside of the data. It's not a report necessarily. It's downloadable, but it's a table within Amazon. Yeah, any Amazon Seller Central account can get in there now. It's post beta. So it's available. Search Query Performance, SQP.
Oh, right. Is this within your ads? That's within the ad campaign?
Nope. It's in a different area. It's around like brand analytics and search frequency rank in that area. And Search Query Performance is in there. And you can look at your own ASINs and compare them to what, and Amazon already tells you what the market is. They know what the market is. So they give you the data to identify. And the easiest way to think about this for me, Trevor, is it's like, okay, I've got a product. Let's call it, we sell a bartender kit, for example, a nice bartender kit for home. You want to make cocktails. That bartender kit might have a keyword that it outperforms the market on, and I'm not running ads on it. It might mean like it's 5 to 10 sales a month, but I'm not running ads on it. But now I can identify that it's outperforming the market. why wouldn't I start running ads on that keyword, right? I would start running ads on that keyword because I know I'm outperforming the market on click-through rate and conversion rate. It just only makes sense to put our ads dollars where we have an advantage over the competitors.
So when you're looking to launch a new product, what kind of process do you go for that?
I built my own process a few years ago, actually. And so we wait. The weightings change over time. We look at it, but we take it and extract all the data that we can to understand what that sub-market looks like or that niche looks like. And we understand, is there, you know, it's the simple things that we always talk about, but the simple things add up to being successful or not successful. Are the unit economics good? Is there enough demand? Can I penetrate the market? Is it so hard? You know, some of these products have 200,000 reviews right now. I don't want to go compete against somebody that has 200,000 reviews on a marketplace. You'll just get washed out. No one will even look at your product, right? So can we, does it have the basic fundamentals of a product that can be successful and set us up to be successful? And then the last thing that's really important nowadays is, can I differentiate my product to make it a better product in the marketplace to meet what customers want?
Okay. So how do you, I mean, you, obviously that sounds like quite a lot of work. How do you manage your business? Do you have a team of people doing this?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have a team here, small team here in Phoenix, and then got a team overseas, India, Philippines.
So how do you find dealing with overseas teams? Because that's the kind of, you know, always, you know, people like Tim Ferriss are very much, you know, everyone needs like a overseas PA, but I've always found them quite, you know, just difficult to manage.
The biggest challenge for us is the cultural piece of it, right? So the culture is different. It's hard to get them to speak up a lot of times, especially the Philippines. It's hard for them to voice their opinion, or I'll say, hey, we found this. And they're like, oh yeah, I knew that was wrong. I really want you to speak out. We have to challenge them a lot of times to speak out. And the culture doesn't want to tell you the bad things a lot of times. So I find that we have to make it a more comfortable setting for them to give us the bad news that they should be getting. You know, Americans be like, hey, this thing sucks. This is terrible, right? Philippines, it's more of a culture. So really understand the culture in which the country you work with. But they're not quite as proactive, I find. They don't want to, you know, they're not always the engine of innovation, I guess I'd call it, right? So I think depending on the role, I think it's great. I have a couple people that are absolutely amazing from like a organizational structure, project management perspective. They're wired to do that. But we don't have anybody overseas that's driving product innovation, for example.
Okay, because I found, I mean, I'm, you know, people we've used, they just think the problem is the quality's patchy, I find. Sometimes they do a brilliant job and sometimes they do a rubbish job. And
I feel like that all the time, Trevor. In America, too, to be honest with you.
That is true. That is true, unfortunately. So how do you, I mean, you mentioned, you know, things are getting more competitive. How have you managed to maintain profitability through, because, you know, when competition's increasing and the whole kind of COVID thing, how do you keep on top of stuff?
I mean, there's no lie. I mean, anybody that tells you that it's getting easier is lying to you. I mean, it's getting more difficult. I think about it this way. In the past 5-10 years, you could be good at one or two things and do revenue and have revenue and make profit. Now you've got to be good at 10 things to make profit. You've got to have your COGS dialed in. You have to have your inventory and supply chain dialed in. You've got to have your marketing spot on. You've got to have your listing spot on. You've got to have your images spot on. I mean, not that you didn't want to do that in the past. It's more critical now because just the level of competition has increased. So we find that we're much more granular in how our processes are built, how we stick to things, and we're more ruthless about products. We don't try to keep products that, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, stuff that's made in China, it just isn't profitable. Margin has been completely eroded. A good example is a few years ago, I was one of the top sellers of patio lights, patio lights. When I started selling it, I think it was like $60 to $70 for a set, like a 48-foot strand. By the time I got out, Chinese sellers were selling them for two sets for $40. The margin has been completely eroded. And I had a good 2 to 3 year run with that product. But at the end of the day, there was no profit left to sell that product on a marketplace.
So do you get stuff made in the US now?
I do. Yeah, I mean, we've always had a supplement brand, or not always, I should say, last 4 years. So we've been making supplements in the US. We haven't done beauty yet. My wife really wants to start a beauty brand. We've looked at other things we can make in North America, because I do feel like the overseas, they just have an advantage, right? I mean, a lot of these factories now are selling on the marketplaces, and they've gotten a lot better. Their branding is better. Their messaging is better. Some of their product quality has gotten better. They're still not great with the brand names, at least on Amazon. Some of the brand names are a little funky. We find that if we can make it here, if we have some type of advantage making the product, it goes a long way down the road to continuing profitability.
Okay. Because, I mean, you're right. I mean, if you go on to look, particularly in Amazon US, you just see, you get a list of the top products. A lot of them are normally Chinese sellers.
That's correct.
That's what Donald Trump doesn't like. You know, the Chinese. It's true.
Yeah, as I say, I don't have a problem of where they come from. It's the problem of some of the tactics, I think, where it doesn't really matter the country. But, you know, the margin goals are different depending on the country that the seller is from. And they have some inherent advantages sometimes where the government in China will subsidize the volume. And or they're not paying U.S. taxes.
Puts them in all of those things.
So it stacks up. It makes it challenging in some categories to compete.
So I can see the sign behind you. You've got the I'm the One podcast. Tell me about what inspired you to start a podcast.
So it wasn't really my idea, to be honest with you. I came back to the office on a Friday earlier in 23, maybe summertime, maybe May. It was May of 23. And my team said, hey, you're starting a podcast. And I was like, oh, okay. This sounds fun. What are we going to do? And they had a bunch of names that they'd come up with and some branding already done. It was like a Friday afternoon planning meeting without me. And I said, what's the catalyst? And like, you love teaching. You like sharing. You talk about the same stuff all the time about, you know, wealth, being an entrepreneur, health, family. You talk about the same stuff. We're going to do a podcast. You're going to talk about those things. So that was the catalyst to starting it. We went on summer vacation for a couple of months, my family and I, and then got back in August and we started the pod. The whole idea is really, it's the three core tenets of life for me. It's wealth, health, and relationships. How do I achieve an A in all three of those categories on a consistent, regular basis, which is really challenging. So many of us entrepreneurs forego the other two or one of the other two categories to get the wealth piece of it, right? How do you stay in shape? How do you maintain, especially as we get older? I don't know how old you are, Trevor, but I'm getting older. So I've got to work a little harder to stay healthy and stay fit.
You call your hair, unlike me. It's nice. Hair's... So how would you score yourself on those three attributes?
I mean, I'd give myself in wealth and in health and probably a B in relationships right now. I think that's 24. I'd like to spend more time with friends. Family's great, but more time with friends. I don't spend as much time with friends as I probably should or would like to, I guess you'd say.
So how much time do you spend there? Because I noticed in your picture you got big arms. Do you spend a lot of time in the gym?
I work out regularly. I've got a full gym at the house. A lot of people talk about like work life balance. I think about it like work life integration, right? So my kids, I've got two daughters, 15 and 13. Like my oldest daughter has never played baseball or softball. We went to the batting cages last night and hit baseballs. So try to be physically active with the family. We run together, work out together, like try to integrate family and health and friends too. I had a buddy of mine, we went to his house for New Year's Eve and I'm like, come over to my house tomorrow. Cause he's like, I want to get a gym at my house. I'm like, come to my house tomorrow. I'll show you everything I've got. I'll break it down for you and tell you what you need to buy so you can have a functional home gym and you can start working out. Cause he's got some fitness goals for 2024. So I think it's integration for me, and that's what's fun. I get excited talking about that stuff. So that's part of the podcast and just sharing my experience with people. When I started doing sauna and cold plunge earlier last year, and I did tons of research. That's just the way I am. So anybody wants to buy a sauna, I'm like, hey, listen, I got tons of data about saunas. I can share all my data and what I've done for research and just shortcut that for them.
Okay. So you're a bit of a kind of body hacker.
I you tell me it's something cool and there's some data around it, I'll put it into my body. I'm willing to try new stuff all the time. So I'm not afraid to try new stuff.
Okay, so here we go. I want three data points from you, right? Okay, what are your three bits of advice for entrepreneurs?
Number one, have a clear goal of what you want to achieve. I think too many people start off saying, I want to be an entrepreneur, and they don't really know what that means. Do you want to be self-employed or do you want to be a business owner? What does it look like? You know, map it out, because it's going to be really easy to work 80 hours a week in the beginning. So map out what you want. That's number one. Number two, once you've decided what you want to do, find a group of like-minded people. I co-founded a mastermind called No BS in e-commerce 6 years ago. We get together three times a year, a bunch of successful entrepreneurs. We share a house. We get a chef. We share best practices, what's working, what's not working. One of the smartest decisions I ever made is because we've all grown together and we care about each other and we try to share with each other and we all get better because nobody's an island unto themselves. Right? So that's number two, is find a network of people. And then number three is don't let yourself get sucked into the entrepreneur. A lot of us that are driven and type A personalities, it's really easy to forget about the other parts in life. And, you know, many people say that if you don't have your health, you only got one problem. And you've got to have health. I'm a big believer in staying healthy, you know, especially I've always been healthy and I've always been fit, but it's really, as I've gotten older, I see a lot of guys and some women, but a lot of guys that are, you know, not healthy. They're 45,
it's
40.
Big portions of food you have. That's what
Americans,
it is.
Well, we struggle in America with this. It's a real problem. It's a serious issue, a serious health issue. And I think that most people don't focus on it until something hits them, right? And it affects them personally. And I just think that it's one of those things where it's a, you've got to put the time and energy early. So those are my three tips.
Okay. So, okay, last question for you. What has inspired you recently? What, you got a tip for like a movie or a book or just something, I don't know, the landscape of Phoenix?
My gut answer to that is my kids. You know, well, and here's why. I had a big pitch to a celebrity recently, and he didn't, I don't know if it got to him or not, but it got to his wife, and his wife said no, via email. So I don't even think she read the full pitch. And I got the response, and I was a little bummed out about it because we put a lot of time and energy into the pitch. And my oldest daughter, who's 15, goes, is that bad? She goes, maybe. Maybe it's good. Maybe it dodged a bullet. Because we've talked about the old Chinese parable around this. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe it was a good thing. Maybe it was a bad thing.
What is the old Chinese parable about this?
I'll butcher this, Trevor. But what it is an older man and his son. And his son, they get a horse. And the man falls off the horse. They get a horse. And the whole village says, oh, congratulations, you got a horse. He said, they're like, that's great. He's like, maybe. The next day, his son gets on the horse, rides the horse, falls off the horse, and breaks his leg. And the village says, oh, that's terrible. I can't believe he fell off. He says, maybe. And then the next day, the army comes to take away his son for the military, but he has a broken leg and can't take him away. He said, well, that's great. Maybe. And the whole idea goes on is we don't really know whether it's good or bad, right? We too often ascribe a good or bad to a situation, right? We don't really know until later on, until time passes, whether it's a good or bad thing. And it was amazing that my 15-year-old did that. I was happy that
there's a good,
proud of her.
Yeah. No, that's a good point. I mean, I don't know if you've read any Malcolm Gladwell, but he wrote
huge
a book
fan.
Called he wrote sorry? You're a huge fan.
Huge
well,
fan.
I really the book of his I liked, I'm glad to hear the book of his I liked the most was David and Goliath. And his thing is about, you know, the strong are not as strong as they think they are, and the weak is not as weak. And it is possible to, you know, certain things in my life that I did when I went to a good university, and I always thought, I didn't go to a very good, we call them, you know, my secondary school, my high school. I didn't go to a very good high school, but I went to a very good university. And I used to think that I got into my very good university despite the fact that I didn't go to a very good high school. But then I thought the other way, and I read that book and I thought, you know, maybe it was because of it, because the fact that I went to a not very good high school meant that I was the top of that not very good high school, which made me think I was really great. And it gave me the confidence to do things which I mightn't have had if I'd gone to a much better high school. And it just gave me, you know, there's a difference, but like a difference of perspectives, like what you were saying. I think you can look at things in different ways, and it is actually possible. Like another example, I had a friend of mine that my parents always taught me that you should, it's a bit of a trite example, you should always eat the stale bread, the old bread first. right? Because it's going off, yep. And you should eat it. Another friend of mine who came along and said, no, you should eat the fresh bread first because it tastes better. And I was like, I thought that was amazing. I just thought, you've got two entirely logical solutions to the same problem. They're both, in their own way, entirely logical. And I'd never thought of it like that. Just, anyway.
There's a great mental model around this. I'm big on mental models. And it's inversion. So take the same concept and just look at it from the opposite way and see if you feel the same way about it. Exactly what you're saying about the bread. One is tackling from the end and one is tackling from the good side. All we did was flip our perspective. The bread stays the same. We just yes. moved to the other side on how we look at it. All we did was invert our shift in our perspective. So when I see something, I try not to judge good and bad quickly. And I try to say, is this, you know, what are the good things about it? What are the bad things about it? And then look at it from a different perspective. And for me, that helps tremendously. I don't really have the ups and downs I had when I was younger, I think, because you don't know sometimes until time passes whether it was a good thing or a bad thing.
Yeah. Rob, you're an insightful man with an interesting story. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me, Trevor. I appreciate it.
Where can we check? Where can people find you online before we go?
Check out imtheonepodcast.com. It's also imtheone.com, and it's also on Spotify and Apple Podcasts.
Excellent. Right. Cheerio, Rob. Nice to meet you. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
Let's just stop this. That. Stop.